case. Now that would be a fun thing to play with. Yes.
Hi, good evening, Roy. Good evening, Wes. A lot of those NMR powered amplifiers are designed for different frequencies, so you're going to have different response rates, and really you need to absolutely check the input and output impedance of those things. They're not necessarily 50 ohms, and you know, they're a complex device, just like the radios that we use and the amplifiers we use, and we'll definitely want filtering. If you're using them unfiltered, you're probably going to have spurious emissions.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jeff. I believe that when Wesley brought up this subject about a month ago, it might have been even Ed, who mentioned that they had to really do a good job with a low band pass filter to get rid of the harmonics that probably are all over that output.
Yes, I believe so. The thing is that I'm extremely careful with working on it. I don't want to damage it. It's like a pressure unit for me. And knowing that this is it weighs more than my wife. Even though the amplifier by itself is extremely small and flat inside, the amount of electronic that is inside and the power supply, oh boy, the power supply takes half of a box. And it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So I didn't really try to open that, what is beneath that, and see what kind of filtering is there. But I believe for NMR, and Dr. Roy, you would probably know what frequencies, why that amplifier has so wide bandwidth. Why start from 5 megahertz to 300 megahertz and some of them to 700 megahertz? What frequencies of NMR for the specimen, if I could use this word, different specimens are being used? Internship.
Look up Larmor frequency. Larmor frequency. Did you get that, the Wesley? Thanks, Jeff, by the way. Like I said before, I never actually used NMRs in chemistry. I used other fascinating devices. I, of course, knew about them. And I would assume there is a wide range because there are many chemical bonds that and chemicals that are used in NMR devices. So it has to be a lot more flexible than the standard magnetic resonance imaging mode that's used by medicine.
I'm quickly trying to find it. Based on what you're trying to get resonance for, some resonances start from 60 hertz, and some resonances start from 300 megahertz. I mean, if I could use the nuclear magnetic resonance, yes. Could I use the word resonance? I don't have a specific terminology that I'm trained with to use for it, but can you correct me, Dr. Roy?
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. The Larmor frequency apparently is specific to each nucleus. It ranges, as you mentioned, it ranges from 4 to 600 megahertz, but I'm not quite sure what the question is.
You actually said it. Larmor frequency specific for given nuclear resonance expectation and energy.
Okay, it's a fascinating field. It's a little, I think, on the esoteric side. I don't know how many people work with NMRs. I've seen a lot of papers that cite the results of NMR. You, matter of fact, once sent me a paper that was, they had taken a very esoteric, I think, organometallic, and changed the metal from it and measured the change in the NMR. I think it, you might have thought it had something to do with transmutation of that metal.
Six Nobel Prizes in NMR.
So, okay, that's good. Like I said, it's a bit esoteric for my taste, but it's used in a lot of research papers and a lot of research labs, and it's made loads of money for the guys who repurposed it for human bodies and had the brilliant idea to market it as a magnetic resonance imaging and get rid of that nuclear word that scares everyone.
Okay, I find something. My problem is that I can recall the right words for given subject. Americans who were born here, and then I have it at the end of the talk. John, KC2WGB, was helping me out, always just giving me that word. Let me know. So I'm a frequency in megahertz, the gyro magnetic ratio in megahertz Tesla, and we have a P as a strength of static magnetic field in Tesla. So that was the word that was missing, but talking about the frequencies, hydrogen 1 is 42.58 megahertz slash Tesla, so on Tesla, in general magnetic value. Fluorium, 19 is 40.5 megahertz. Sodium 23 is 11.26, and P31, gosh, Dr. Roy, an alphabet. What is P?
Phosphorus?
Phosphorus, okay. I'm sorry, I'm getting old. It's 17.24. Those were what I thought. When we have NMR still working on 700 megahertz, I believe it is not 700 megahertz. It is from a certain low frequency to 700 megahertz. But if anybody has more information, I would be glad if you talk.
Okay, Wesley, I don't want to confuse people, but basically the Lamour frequency is sort of, it's based on the nucleus, on the precession of the nucleus as it spins, or does in quantum mechanics what's considered spinning. So, that's sort of what Lamour frequency amounts to. It's precessional motion of the nucleus, if anyone's taking notes out there.
Well, actually, I understand that as a problem to appear in nuclei causing cancellation of individual angular momentum and direction.
This is very basic stuff, Wes.
Was I doubling?
No, you weren't. I'm just telling you, it's very basic stuff.
Well, yes, it is. Yes, it is. It is just voicing it or trying to be fluent in explanation was always my problem. When I was trying fast to form the answer and to achieve it. Okay, Dr. Roy.
Okay, AC2GS, thank you, Wesley, and I wish you good luck with the amplifier, and when you use it for something, I'm sure you'll come back and and tell us how it went and how it worked. And, you know, once again, if anyone's giving away free suitcase mass spectrometers, I might be interested. But NMRs is a little bit too esoteric for my taste these days. With that in mind, before we begin the Paul's space report, I just want to ask people, because sometimes they're interested and sometimes they're not, if you want to ask any questions or bring up any topics related to the coronavirus, I'm able to give you some, you know, reasonable ideas of what I've gleaned from the subject. So it's up to you. If anyone has any questions, please feel free at this time.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
Monday, I was driving in my car listening to NPR, and there was a report about some new studies saying that masks are actually pretty good to protect you from others. Not as good as they are protecting others from you, but they are definitely a value protecting you from others. And they said they're not perfect, but studies have shown even if you do get the virus, it tends to be less severe. Can you comment on that, elaborate, deny, what have you?
Okay, all of these research studies are preliminary and haven't been double or triple or quadruple checked, so they are subject, unfortunately, to change. And this annoys a lot of people. They like their science to be very clean and concise. They don't like two steps forward, one step back. Primarily, face coverings that are not the N95 or similar masks are primarily used not to protect the mask wearer, but the other people in the room. So that's the primary benefit. There might be a smaller benefit to the actual person wearing the mask. The problem is that the mask has all kinds of pore sizes, so that even small droplets can probably find their way through the mask if someone hasn't already worn their mask to stop the droplets from coming out of their mask. So it is of some benefit. Viral loads is open to interpretation. There are some people who assume that a low viral load will lead to a less severe illness and less a percentage of mortality and complications. Unfortunately, I haven't seen any consistent research that demonstrates it to anyone. And if all of the above improves your chances to suffer it, is anyone's guess.
All right, thanks.
AC2PO, quick question.
Yes, please.
Hi, Roy. Thanks for taking the question. I have a friend who's taking occasional doses of rituximab to wipe out B cells for an autoimmune condition. The papers state that the B cells come back, and there, as you know, there are many progenies of and different lineages of immune cell types, but in general, the B cells will be back entirely by 1 year. But the memory B cells do not come back to the same level, even approaching the same level by that time. So, two questions, actually. One is, are all of the childhood illnesses that the person had been exposed to, is their adaptive immunity gone for those? And number two, what are the dangers for a person who's taking rituximab infusions during this dangerous time of viral infection? Go ahead.
Well, as far as childhood immunity developed, that's probably, I would assume, going to impact. I haven't read anything in the literature about it one way or the other, but it would seem to make sense to me. As far as the infection, it's still up in the air. We don't really know how much T-cell versus B-cell versus antibody kind of all factors into these things, as you no doubt have read a lot or worked on. There's this strange thing that goes on with antibodies. They find that, especially when they check in China, which has the longest period of infection, that the antibodies drop down, but they're hoping that the B and T cells kind of make up for that as well, and they haven't come to any conclusion as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I think the same thing, and that's why we have been testing IgGs, IgAs, and IgMs, and you know, measuring titers for all of that stuff in the peripheral blood cells. But thank you very much for taking the question, Ryan. Thank you for all you're doing for the net.
You're welcome, Jeff, and thanks for participating. Thanks to everyone who participates. And that's a good segue for me to once again remind you people that if you want to pass any questions and you can't get on to the net proper, or you have any topics you want to hear discussed, or you have any puzzles you would like me to share with people out there, or tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him what he thinks about something you saw about space, the email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links to articles, as I mentioned, I put up two YouTube videos on very simple concepts of impedance, but they're entertaining and enjoyable. So please take a look at them when you have a chance. Go to roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll find those links. And tell your friends and family that if they want to listen to the audio stream live, they can by just typing into their browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, MikeKC2NJI's amateurradio.tv site is a wonderful source of archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006. And as always, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight on my part of the technical net, and of course, Andy for Andy's Corner, and I'd like to present Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good. And, I was reading the... Reading the chat room, and it was very good. And so much was going into it, I had to read fast. And so it was very active tonight. And I mean, in regard to Andy's topics, so I'm glad he'll be back next week. That makes it interesting. A few topics I wanted to start off with. One. Will be this Thursday. I wanted to get this because I've been talking about this for months, is the launch of the 2020 rover Perseverance that will be going to Mars in the morning, so you'll be able to watch it on the NASA site. You go to NASA.gov, and there's a link to watch live, see if this thing gets off the ground. And I think it will, unless the weather's bad. Because the Spive rocket, which is highly reliable, they've been credited with like 100% success rate since they started with the Atlas V. And I think they're up to almost 80 launches. So we'll look for that on Thursday. We'll look for that on Thursday. That's the one with the helicopter. We're going to test that on the February 18th. And if that works out, future flights will also have helicopters, and this time they'll have more science equipment and things on board the helicopter, but they've got to be able to see if this thing takes off and lands. You know, they're planning at least five flights, you know, each one getting longer than the next, you know, go up for a minute, come down for, and then go up for a minute and a half, that type of thing. Travel further distances, so on and so forth. So, let me see, there's another important event that will happen next Sunday before the year, before this net. Let me drop it. And that will be the landing of the crew that went up on May 20th. They went up on the Falcon 9 rocket, and they'll be coming back next Sunday morning, again with the weather permitting. What they plan on doing is landing in the Atlantic Ocean. So that will be Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. And it's the first time that the Dragon spacecraft will have a crew in it. They've done it before without a crew two marches ago, and that worked out okay. So they'll come down with four parachutes. Look a little different than the Apollo missions. They come down with three parachutes. But looking forward to that anyway. Let me drop it, see if anybody has any questions. Okay. Now, Roy is very successful with his quizzes. He's big on that, and I thought I'd give it a try with at least one quiz for this evening, dealing with space history. So here's the question. You can get and the answer could be close, within range, but the question is, what was the first rocket to be launched from the Cape, from down in Florida, Cape Canaveral? What was either the name of the rocket or with the year? And I wonder if anybody has that. This could be very easily found on Google. I thought this is a good question. There's been countless flights, of course, afterwards. But what was the first one? This is WS2M.
KC2FYJ.
KC2FYJ, go right ahead.
Stupid, wild-ass guess, but was it an Atlas?
No, that's further down the line. It predated the Atlas. One of the earlier ones. Atlas was actually a different decade, or an earlier decade than that.
Wasn't there a Redstone?
Yeah, this is how they got the Redstone rocket. They got, you're actually almost right. It just predated the Redstone, but the Redstone got its design from this particular rocket. Anybody else?
Don't tell me your V2.
I won't tell you it's the V2, but it is the V2. They had a name for it. It was called, they bought them over from Germany after the war. And, we set them up in New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico. And there were some launches there, some orbital launches, and they were trying to test them. And the earliest ones, failed. They had problems. But eventually they got it to get up to 200 miles high in New Mexico. But then what they wanted to do, they wanted to try launching it, and they wanted to have a second stage on it. See, the V2 in Germany was just one stage. Ethanol, it was 75% ethanol, 25% water, and then they had liquid oxygen. And they would, that's how they launched them. But
Now, when we got a hold of it, you know, we wanted naturally more range. And, they improved on it, and they put a second stage on it. Now, they knew they had a good chance of having the second stage ignite by going straight up. They needed to go horizontally. They wanted to see if the stage would ignite. It was very tricky back then to try to ignite a second stage. And they wanted to see if it could be done as it was going horizontally. So this thing went up 10 miles, and it went 200 miles out to sea. So they couldn't do it in New Mexico. They might kill a jackrabbit or something, or hit somebody out on the highway. Sure wasn't there. It wasn't that occupied, but they sure weren't going to take a chance over land. So they said, let's go to Cape Canaveral. And that's what happened. It was 1950, and it was July 24th, a couple of days ago. But they changed the name of the B-2 rocket, of course. They called it the Bumper Project, Bumper 1, Bumper 2, Bumper 3. And they only launched two from Cape Canaveral to do this type of test. And it was the Bumper 7 and Bumper 8 rocket, and 8 went before 7, because the 7 had a function. And then later on they launched that. They were off to the races after that. It worked. They got their second stage to ignite. And then the other station, I said Redstone, they took this same idea and started developing similar components, except bigger in the Redstone, which of course was eventually used to launch suborbital Mercury missions, which eventually got Alan Shepard off the ground and Gus Grissom. And then after that, they needed orbital flights. And they went eventually to the other station said was the Atlas for John Glenn and those flights. So any comments or questions, and we'll just move on here if not. I'll try to come up with other questions. Mostly space history is pretty good. Any other comments?
KD2FIU.
Hello, George. How are you? And back to you.
Good evening, Paul. WS2N. Yeah, I just joined in here. And listening to this, and you came up with the answer with the 1950. And was this, my question is, was this a Von Braun project?
To myself, yeah. Yeah, they sent him to New Mexico and put these B-2 rockets that were dragged back from Germany. And he was involved with that, and he continued to get involved. He helped out with he helped develop the Redstone rocket as well in Huntsville, Alabama. And yes, Von Braun, and of course, he was successful, and as time went on, he really became the father of the space program for the early years. But back to you, George.
Thank you, Paul, KD2FIU. And, very interesting as to his contribution over... I don't know whether he started working in where, and the work really started where. The experiments, as you mentioned, were in New Mexico, but the engineering work must have had seeds in other places. And I'm not asking you to answer that right now, but I'm trying to think of where they were working in 1949 and 1950. Over to you, Paul.
You know, the name Redstone, that, yeah, the Redstone Army Proving Ground, in Huntsville, Alabama, and that's where they came up with that name. So, yeah, work was going on there, and Von Braun, of course, was instrumental in that. And when he was in Germany, you know, before the war, he found out about Goddard, you know, everybody here pretty much knows who Goddard is, and the first guy to come up with the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And so it was very small, but it worked. And then he would actually call him up. Von Braun would call up Goddard, you know, and ask him questions, you know, what about this and what about that. So, they, you know, although it's a German rocket, he got a lot of ideas from Goddard. He would tell him things. And then, of course, he started developing it. And then they come up with the V-2, which was actually, you know, in Goddard's mind, he was thinking, well, let's use this to eventually go to the moon. But you know what Germany was thinking, unfortunately. So, there you go. Any other comments?
AC2PL query.
AC2PL, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking of the fuel, the early fuels. You said that the balance of the fuel was oxygen, ethanol, the balance was in water, and I'm wondering if it was because they couldn't control the stoichiometry, or if it was a cooling effect, or what have you. I know obviously they went to ultimately hydrogen and oxygen, but there have been azides and other things that were early on used as well, but the water is an interesting one.
Yeah, they had liquid oxygen, you know, for the oxidizer, and the fuel was ethanol 75, and like I said, water had mixed in with that, and that gave it a cooling, like you said, a cooling effect, keep the combustion chamber cool, and then they could control it better, less of a chance of, like, blowing up the chamber. So, yeah, that's the reason they use that. And they use other chemicals, too. They use hydrogen peroxide and a catalyst. And they would take this hydrogen peroxide with a catalyst, and that would instantly turn to steam, high-pressure steam. And they would pipe that to one turbine. And the turbine would spin. And off the turbine, they had one shaft going one way, the other shaft going the other way. And each one would spin pumps. One would be spinning the ethanol water pump, and the other one would be spinning the liquid oxygen pump, you know, dozens of gallons into the combustion chamber. So, and it worked, you know, that's how they started out. Now there's so many different variations of that same system. In fact, the Russians, I think they still use it to some extent on the Soyuz rocket, this hydrogen peroxide system, to spin up there. They might have been, I mean, for a lot of flights, they might have changed that, but I know the Russians were big on that for many, many years as well. Back to you.
WG2AP.
Station recognized. I could just imagine that the, you know, the angular momentum problems are controlling them had to be difficult. Anyway, thank you very much. Back to net.
The other station sounded like EAV. I should know your name. Back to you.
It's Ed. Just want to point out, the hydrogen peroxide you buy in the drugstore is 3%. If you know 100%, it is one of the nastiest chemicals ever invented.
Understood. I should have said concentrated hydrogen peroxide. Yes, yeah, that's it. You wouldn't want to put this stuff on your skin. You're right about that. Any other comments? Okay, very good. The
NASA's getting ready for another experiment. Actually, they're going to do the experiment in 2022. And their ultimate goal is laser communications with Earth. And they want to do this for, you know, pretty much as eventually to send more data down from a space station to Earth, but eventually to transmit back and forth from the moon as well. So in an upcoming flight, they're going to send a communication, I call it a radio, but it's a laser communication relay device to a geosynchronous satellite. Actually, it's going to take a ride on another geosynchronous satellite, so it'll be a secondary payload. Once it's in orbit, they plan on contacting Earth. They'll be over one same spot on Earth all the time. So as long as there's, you know, clear weather, they'll be able to test out their laser. Once they do that, get it, you know, make sure everything works fine. They want to put one of these things also on the International Space Station as a test, which will be great. Because that, you know, once they get used to using something like that, or work all the bugs out of it, you'll be able to have, you know, constant communications, or almost constant. Let me drop it. So, that, you know, that's the ultimate goal. I mean, eventually they plan on eventually having a base on the moon. You could communicate directly to Earth. The moon is always facing Earth. And even if the weather is bad on Earth, you could communicate with another one of these satellites that are in orbit that have this same setup on it, and that eventually could relay the information back down to Earth. And ultimate goal would be to put it on what they call the Gateway. They're working on the Gateway, which is another smaller space station, not like, you know, not a big space station like the International Space Station, but, you know, maybe with four or five modules instead of, you know, what we have, about 16 different modules on the space station. But, you know, three or four, you know, you'll have a habitat one, you'll have a propulsion module, and, you know, you'll eventually have a crew on there for maybe months at a time. And they'll be able to communicate video and everything, no problem. You know, high def and everything from the moon or from the Gateway space station. So that's the future. But for now, they want to be able to test this thing from geosynchronous orbit to Earth. Any comments?
KC2FYJ with a question.
KC2FYJ, go right ahead.
I presume they're looking to do that because of bandwidth capability. But of course, then you have to have concern about, as you pointed out, weather conditions. Is it possible to generate radio frequencies at the spectrum of light and just do it by radio?
Well, I'll go back to what I used to hear from the deck. You know, essentially, you know, light is, you know, really nothing but a radio frequency up in the, you know, the, I used to have all the different numbers memorized. I forget what it was. Yeah, he had all the colors and everything. He could tell you what wavelength it was. I can't remember. I forgot. But you know, yeah. But you can't get a radio to, you know, an oscillator to go that high. At least not yet. You know, they go up pretty high, but they're not going to get as high as light. So you're 100% right. The bandwidth is what they really need to be able to do. You know, two-way communications and with TV and high def, you know, that would do it. Back to you.
Paul?
You probably got the numbers that I'm missing. Back to you, Rory.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to point out that, it's all electromagnetic spectrum. Radio frequency goes up to near infrared, and then you have infrared, and you have infrared, near infrared, you have visible light, you have near ultraviolet, ultraviolet, and then it's that never never land that's either gamma rays or X-rays, depending upon whether or not you're an astronomer. So you could have a very wide bandwidth in a light transmission. You would have to simply use a device that emitted a high-frequency electromagnetic waves like a laser. So you could, I guess, basically tune a laser to give you a wide bandwidth, narrow range, dispersion signal. It would sort of work the same sort of way that radio waves do.
KC2FYJ comment.
Here you go.
Okay, I had YJ is...
Okay, first, I thought that there was a slight difference between a straight radio wave and emitted light because, and maybe my understanding is just wacky, but I thought the photons were involved in visible light and they did not have a part to play in radio waves, but I could be completely wrong there. And second, Roy, I actually did exactly that when I was a young kid. My cousin and I got a laser tube from somewhere, Edmund Scientific, I think it was, and we built a circuit from an issue of Popular Electronics magazine. You remember that? And it basically modulated the light beam, and we aimed it across the backyard to a photocell that was connected to an amplifier and a speaker. And I spoke into the unit that had the laser tube on it and said to my cousin, if you can see this, jump up and down. And a moment later, on the other side of the backyard, he started jumping up and down. So it absolutely is doable.
Very good. Okay. Yeah. I think 550 nanometers or something. That was green, different colors. But this will all be lasers. Roy, did you want to comment on that? He was kind of directing that to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to. There was always been an interesting conversation about the duality of electromagnetism, and there are people who kind of have the idea that it's a wave under some circumstances and a particle under others. The problem ultimately is we don't really have a good sense of what electromagnetism is. It acts both as a wave in waves and as a particle. So the way we fudge it is we talk about wave-particle duality. What it really amounts to is it's something else that has those strange qualities that we haven't been able to figure a good way to explain. So there's nothing inherently different between gamma rays and radio waves and light waves except for their frequency, and because of their frequency, their inherent energy level. So they have different characteristics in which they bounce off of things, or they go right past things, or they ionize things, or they just warm up things. But ultimately, photons and electromagnetic waves, is it someplace in between that we can't quite put our finger on yet?
WB2EAB, go ahead.
The only thing that makes light unique is that by a lucky accident, and blame God for this one, is we actually see things in that frequency band. Other than that, it's just one more point on the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, second item, you were talking about using lasers from your applications. The problem is, a laser benefit is its very narrow beam. The problem is, you have to aim that incredibly narrow beam at the receiver. Now, if everything is fixed, it's not that big a deal, but if everything is moving, it becomes a nightmare.
KC2FYJ, comment.
KC2FYJ, go ahead.
That, I think, can be addressed by using a lens system so that you diffuse the laser beam so that it's no longer coherent, but it's spreading out. It may still be coherent in terms of all of the ups and downs happening at the same time, but instead of going parallel, you can spread it out. And if you spread it out, you'll lose some of the intensity because it's over a wider area, but you no longer have to have such precise aiming capability.
Yeah, but you lose orders of magnitude of intensity to get any kind of beam spreading. It's a tremendous trade-off.
True, it's distance squared, but they have some incredibly sensitive light-sensing devices. You can, for example, get lightning detectors that they'll detect lightning strikes when you can't see them at all. So it may not be quite as difficult as some might make it out to be. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
KC2GS.
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I just want to add, Harry mentioned, there's two types of coherence in lasers. There's the temporal coherence, that's the phase relationship, and then there's something called spatial coherence. That's the thing that gets disrupted by putting it through a lens. So you can still have something that's no longer spatially coherent, but it maintains a temporal phase coherence.
Okay. Well, I'm sure they're working on all of this, but I know they have the reflector on the moon that Apollo 11 left behind. A couple of the other ones left them behind as well. The other Apollo missions, on the moon, so we can send the laser, and they've done that many times. They do it on a regular basis from New Mexico. They have this telescope, this collimator, like a reverse telescope, and they'll send a beam of light to the surface of the moon. And it comes out, like a pinpoint here, but by the time it gets to the moon, it spreads out a couple of miles. But it still hits the, in diameter, but it still hits the laser, and then gets sent back here. See the light and, measure the exact distance between here and the moon. Not really that good for communications, but, the years are going by and they're getting better and better at focusing these things. Any other comments? They did do this once with, they call it the Lottie mission that went to the moon. It was launched from Virginia. 2013, from Wallace Island, and it had a communicator, laser communicating on it, and they transmitted from there to the Earth, and they were able to pick it up and send a message, a pre-recorded message that it had on the spacecraft, and that was the first test, at that distance, and they were able to get that message. I think there was a picture involved as well. Any other comments? Sam, listen to the ID and the time. So let me just move on. There's another mission I'm looking forward to going up. It's a Russian mission, Progress vehicle, and it'll be going to the International Space Station. The idea is to restock it and refuel parts of that space station. But on board, they do have a tester. I talked about this while I think last night or the night before, an air quality measuring device. Since then, they put in do want to take a test on a regular basis to figure out what's up with this. On a progress machine, progress vehicle, they do have a new one going up, and that will be going up this week as well on Thursday. Now, when it gets there, it's going to dock with the Russian TIRS module. TIRS module is a docking module that's been up there since 2001. And they might do it with this mission. The goal is to get rid of that particular module, the TIRS docking module. It's one of these modules that are facing toward the Earth, and either a manned vehicle or a progress cargo vehicle could dock to it. And what they'd like to do, and they wanted to do this a couple of years ago, but things get delayed in the NASA program and with Roscosmos, the Russians. They want to use a progress vehicle to separate the Pier's docking facility, a module off the space station, and deorbit it and let it burn up over the South Pacific like everything else. And they might do that with this mission, because the goal is to send up the new Nokia module that Russia has been building like for the last 12 years. All kinds of delays with that. And that's a very big module, you know, maybe 30 feet long or something. You know, it's going to be big enough to have another bathroom on board, another multiple science labs, and Russia will eventually get back to their standard three-person crew that they wanted to for the Russian end of it. Right now they're doing everything with two, and which will increase the amount of people on board the space station on a regular basis. For years now we've had six people has been the number. Now we're going up to seven because of our capability now to launch from American soil with the Dragon vehicle. So I'm looking to see if they do that this time. If they do, it'll be a couple of months from now if they load it up with junk. Burn things up, but it's bringing up fuel, oxygen for the people on board. I think it's a couple hundred pounds of liquid oxygen. It's got fuel that attaches to the, or you know, automatically attaches to the spacecraft, and they could refuel parts of the spacecraft to so it has enough power to move out of the way in case it has to. Every now and then it has to do that. You know, in case there's you know, something flying by at, you know, 17,500 miles an hour. So that's the story on that. Let me just move on, unless somebody has a comment. Okay, now China just launched, I talked to a rocket to Mars. I talked about this race to space for you know, for the different countries that are involved going to Mars. Right now, we have three groups of people that have spacecraft either flying around Mars in orbit or on the surface itself. The United States, we have India, and now eventually we're going to have the United Arab Emirates that are going up there, and we have the European Space Agency with they call it the Mars Express, that's going around Mars as well. So now soon in February we're going to have the European United Arab with a orbital spacecraft around Mars, because they successfully got off the ground last week, and now just a few days ago China got off the ground with their heavy lift vehicle on the way to Mars also in February that they'll be getting there. Now there's a lot more involved. The UAE is just an orbiting weather type of satellite, but China, they're getting, you know, they're going all out. They're sending an orbiter up, all set up. This, you know, it's on a cruise right now. Cruise stage will eventually go into orbit around Mars, and then for a couple of months, February until probably April, they'll just be orbiting the planet, and then they have this land that it's going to separate from the orbiter around April, and land. Our missions landed Voyager 2 and Utopia Plateau, and it's in the northern part of the planet, just, you know, north of the equator. So they'll land, and then on top of that they have a rover. It's, they said it's around 500 pound rover that's solar powered, will be riding around on Mars. So right now it's only the Americans, we're the only ones that have ever had successful rovers riding around on Mars. Or for that matter, successful landers. You know, we've had a couple of landers. We had we had the Phoenix way up in the northern latitude. That was a permanent lander. Right now we have InSight also on Mars, still operating. That's a permanent lander without a rover. And then over the years we've had three different rovers. Back in 97 we had the Sojourner rover that went up with Pathfinder, and Pathfinder was the lander, and the rover was about the size of a microwave, and I drove away, and that was the first rover to drive on Mars, and I gave the engineers plenty of help from NASA, because that was successful, and they sent two more rovers up. Spirit and Opportunity, which was supposed to operate, they would have been happy if it landed, you know, lasted 3 months. You know, one went 6 years, that was Spirit, and then the other one went 14 years. That just died, you know, a couple of years ago. And then, of course, we had this successful flight in 2012 of Curiosity, and hopefully we now have this thing that's going up, and on Thursday it will land February 18th, you know, date, February 18th, this massive rover, a little bit bigger than the last one, the Curiosity. Curiosity was like 2,000 pounds. This thing's about 2,200. Of course, it's 3,800ths of that weight. When
complete.
It gets, or, you know, roughly one-third of the weight when it's on Mars, but still, they're big vehicles, six-wheel vehicles that are nuclear-powered, plutonium, roughly 10 pounds of plutonium to generate enough heat to operate all these thermocouples that are set in series and parallel to get higher voltages, to get higher amperages, so that Curiosity can drive around day and night, and the same for Perseverance. So looking forward to getting that thing off the ground this Thursday. So, but China's successful in their launch, and then the United Arab Emirates, they were successful. They didn't launch on their own rocket. They paid Japan to launch theirs. They launched on the Japan H2A rocket, and that worked out okay. We're going to go up on an Atlas V rocket. Let's hope that works out. There's a lot of people, engineers, people involved with that thing for the last, you know, 10, 12 years, developing this 2020 rover. Any comments or questions? Alrighty, we have Virgin Orbiter. I've talked about this company before. Virgin Orbiter is the name of the company. And it's a spinoff of Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic is the company pretty much run by Richard Branson, but there's a lot of other money involved. But he's the main spokesman for them. They're the ones with the spacecraft that attaches to the White Knight 2 vehicle, you know, jet-powered carrier, which brings it up to 45,000 feet and lets the rocket, in this case called Unity, drop, and then it has one rocket engine, and it will give